drawing near. Brothers, sisters, please get ready.
When it comes to our experience with the criminal legal system, one of the entities most apparent to many of us and most prevalent in our lives is our city police department. Here in Shasta County, a large swath of our territory is covered by the sheriff's office, and the Anderson Police Department serves the city of Anderson. But the Redding Police Department has a critical role in serving our most populated area, an area of about 90,000 people and covering over 60 square miles. The RPD has also been responsible for implementing several new programs during current Chief Shuler's tenure, including a park ranger program, bike program, a crisis intervention response team, and most recently, body cams. In our conversation today, I speak with Chief Shuler about his upcoming retirement, his reflections on changes that have occurred over his career and his tenure with the department, and his thoughts on future trends and community needs. This is Bending the Arc. Bending the Arc is a show sponsored by the Shasta Equal Justice Coalition and hosted by KKRN, Community Supported Radio. On this show, we invite deeper conversations with people working to shape the criminal legal system, either individuals working within it or people working for equal justice outside of that system, as well as others working for reform in various arenas. I am your host, Sharon Brizolera. Thank you for joining us today. Today, I had the distinct pleasure of interviewing Chief Bill Shuler. Chief Shuler has served on the Redding Police as Redding Police Chief for 4 years and in the department for 30. Is that correct?
Yeah, it'll be 30 by the time I retire.
You've overseen so many changes, many of which we'll talk about in our interview, but I thought I'd start with your retirement. What are you most looking forward to?
What I'm looking forward to is a lot of things. Travel, getting my health back. This is one of these jobs where it's a never-ending 24/7, 365 job. And I put myself second and the job first. And so I'm looking forward to putting myself first for a while. Want to get in shape. Want to probably get off the blood pressure medications and, go get back to taking care of myself for a while. So I'm looking forward to that. My wife and I plan on traveling as much as we can. She still has to work a little bit longer, but once she retires, then we're going to travel the country in an Airstream. We're going to visit Europe and do all those kind of things. And then I'm looking forward to spending a lot more time with my father and the rest of my family, as we're all getting up there in age. So yeah, looking forward to all those things.
We don't talk necessarily a lot about the physical, much less a physical, emotional, mental, it's all connected.
Oh yeah.
Stress on the body.
There is a lot of stress and both mental and physical in this job and this career field as a whole. And there's been a big change and momentum shift in mental health for police officers and public safety in recent years. But yeah, I've felt the physical effects of it. I've had a couple of visits to the ER with high blood pressure, extremely high blood pressure. And I've definitely paid the toll a little bit on those things. And that's one of the things, get that pressure off my shoulders and get healthy. That's what I'm looking mm-hmm. forward to.
Yeah, that's beautiful. What have you seen in terms of what has shifted in terms of that kind of understanding?
Yeah, when I first started in this career, the thought of seeing a psychologist other than when you're required to, our officers are required to see a psychologist before they're hired, and then they're required to see a psychologist when they're involved in a critical incident. But other than that, the thought of that was, that wasn't something that we would do. We're tough guys, right? We're cops. We're superheroes in our own mind. So going and see a mental health professional there was a stigmatism tied to that. And that has since changed drastically And now we, in fact, we're working on a program right now where we're going to require our staff to go see a psychologist once a year, whether they like it or not. And the officers are happy about this. They want to do that. And we have a very robust employee assistance program with trained mental health professionals that work with just public safety. And so they'll be able to get the assistance they need. I'm not shy to say that I've gone and seen a mental health professional during my career. I think it's important to do that and de-stress and get those things, you know, there's coping mechanisms that you can put into place to deal with stress. And I think those are very valuable. We lost just prior to me becoming chief about 5 years ago, an officer, he had retired, but we lost him to suicide. And it's very commonplace in this profession. You know, I've lost several officers in the last 2 years to post-traumatic stress. And you think about if we had addressed it 10 years ago and made it so that there wasn't shame in getting mental health treatment, that these officers might still have careers today. Back to your original question. Yes, getting my mental health and my physical health in order is a big priority for me. And I'm looking forward to it.
I've certainly seen mental health professionals throughout my life for various reasons. When I lost my house in the car fire or losing my parents, it's hard to navigate trauma sometimes without some support or guidance. Your time as chief has gone through COVID and George Floyd. What you're suggesting about a annual visit, whether you like it or not, sounds very much like an intentional cultural change. Yeah.
In the state of California, I don't always agree with everything the state does, but here I do. They gave every police department in California grant money this year. We received around $70,000, and strictly for the mental health and well-being of police officers to address these issues. So we've been looking at different ideas on what to do with that. The having the annual checkup was something that we had talked about doing a couple of years ago, and then actually had a placeholder in our union contract with our officers to have that discussion. But the funding wasn't there. Now the funding's there, and we're able to get this started. And then the other thing we're doing is, every one of our officers has assigned us a work cell phone for the variety of things that they need to do with their phones. But there's an app called Cortico. Cortico is a company that it was established by some psychiatrists and psychologists. Dr. Black is the primary founder. And this app, every officer, every one of our staff, every employee will have access to this app. And at any time, you can get linked up to a psychiatrist or a psychologist. You can get advice on diet, on health, on whatever you need. You can even get financial assistance, advice at the tip of your fingers with this app. It's all confidential. We don't know who pushes the button or who reaches out. We just pay the service fee, and then our officers have that, or all of our staff has that ability. So that's the two things that we're looking at with our grant funding. We're just going through the process of getting those contracts signed. So I'm excited when those things will go into effect here in the next month or so.
That's really great to hear.
I mean, our officers encounter a lot of trauma throughout their career. I used to work child sexual assault cases for years, and that stuff just doesn't go away. That stuff, sometimes it takes a professional to try and make that stuff get out of your head. And so a lot of our staff sees that, they see people, little kids involved in, traffic accidents. They see little kids that are abused. When you have kids of your own, that makes it very real. So those are all things that, we need to address early on, and make it a normal thing to just go talk about it and get some treatment and don't be shameful. It's not a shameful thing to do that. So. Back in the early 2000s, when I was working in detectives doing those kind of cases, I loved what I did. I loved helping kids. I loved putting these kind of offenders in prison. And I loved working murder cases and doing all of those things. But in that, as you said, that trauma just kind of builds up over time as you think about that, and it compounds and compounds and compounds. And if you don't do something about it, you end up, this is what my psychologist said, it becomes like a volcano and it all erupts. And so you've got to deal with that when it's at its lower level versus waiting for it to blow your stack and you end up in the ER with super high blood pressure.
For example, right?
Car fire was very traumatic for a lot of people in this community, including first responders. And yeah.
Absolutely.
Every time, I mean, you know, the planes start flying over, everyone starts to freak out because of, yep, of what happened then. So
we kind of touched on what brings some people to a career in law enforcement. Thinking back all those years ago, what was it that drew you into becoming a law enforcement officer?
Well, I actually was going to be an electrical engineer. That's what I started going to college for. And I just, it wasn't my thing at the time. And so I took a pause on college and I went in the construction industry for a while and was building houses. And then I'm like, I can't do this the rest of my life. And what do I want to do? And I had a family friend that was in law enforcement. He was and a friend of my father's. And I went on a couple of ride-alongs with him. And this was when I was living in Oregon years ago. And I was hooked. I saw, you know, I mean, at the time, you're in your, you know, late teens, early 20s, and you're like, this is the coolest job on earth, right? I mean, you get to drive fast, chase bad guys, and do all those kind of things. So I started going back to school at night and kept doing that job, and then eventually moved to California and put myself through the academy and was hired by Reading PD in 1994, and I've been here ever since.
So you actually started here.
I started here. Yep. Chief Bob Blankenship hired me and fresh out of the academy. And yeah, it's been a great career. And I love living in Reading. Reading's been a great place.
You know, our ideas of what we want to do with any career can change. Did you start?
Drastically change. Yeah, no. When I first started, I loved being a patrol officer. I loved going to, you know, the calls for service and being out there in the community and stopping people and doing all those, you know, trying to make the community safe and arresting bad guys. The excitement of that was fantastic. And I remember saying to myself, I'll never promote past sergeant. That's, you know, these administrator jobs, I'll never do that. here I am today, right? it's true. As you grow, as you get older, you get wiser, you start thinking about, you know, what you can do and what effect you can have on an agency or your workplace. And so I made the conscious decision pretty early on that I was going to try and take every opportunity I possibly could. So that meant I went to motors and rode motors for 5 years and worked traffic. And then when I had the opportunity to promote and go into detectives, I did that. And I did that for as long as I could until I promoted out of there and went back to patrol. And it was at that point, I was a corporal, a frontline supervisor, and then I became a sergeant. And I remember the former chief, Roger Moore, was a captain at the time. And he was, the administrative sergeant was retiring, I believe, or he was going back to patrol. I can't remember, but regardless, he came to me and said, hey, I'd really like you to come over and work at admin. I'm like, there's no way I'm coming to work for you at admin. I like the street. I like being out doing bad guy stuff. And he's like, no, you really need to think about it. Let's talk about it. And ultimately I did it. And it was a great thing for me because you learn a different aspect of the department. You learn about the hiring practices, right? All of the internal stuff, budget, everything that goes on with the agency. And you have a lot of impact on everything from culture to the people you're hiring to training, all of that. And I really enjoyed that work. And then I got to spend a little bit of time at Shascom while we were trying to get a new director. I spent some time up there. I worked on some really big projects, getting our agency into the 21st century, and then just continue to go from there. I never thought I would be a police chief, nor did I really even have a desire to do that. But it came to the point when the opportunity presented itself and Roger told me he was retiring and I was his captain, one of his captains, I had to make a decision whether it was going to be, do we let somebody from the outside come into this department and potentially change everything we've done, or do I step up and take that role on? So I, you know, after some soul searching and conversations with my family, and I made that decision, and here we are 4 years later. Again, I never thought I would do it, but I'm glad I did it. It's been an interesting ride. There's been a lot of ups and downs, but I'm also looking forward to not doing it anymore.
Right. I'm looking forward to that for you as well. What were some of the things that most interested you that you wanted to do while you were chief? Because you've certainly instituted many new things. Were those on board at the beginning, or did they emerge?
They weren't, like, not everything was on, you know, there. Things have evolved with me over time as, you know, issues have come up in policing, in social justice, all of those things. Where our profession is evolving a lot, very quickly, in fact. And I think, you know, that drove some of those changes that we've made. So I didn't walk into this job thinking, wow, I want to make this big, huge change. I was a captain in patrol. I was Roger Moore's second in command, and we were very close and we agreed on almost everything. So I didn't come in like, oh, I can't wait to change this when I take over. I had very little thought on major change at the time, but then, you know, we started looking forward and ways we could, I mean, we were dealing with a recruiting crisis at the time, and then it got really bad during the George Floyd time. And so that became a big focus. And then, and as you know, the CERT conversation came along and started thinking about ways we could do, what we could do to be different and address some of those issues. So those was kind of, those just evolved over the time in this position. And I, frankly, I have a really good leadership team and we bounce things off each other all the time and come up with ideas on things that we can do to improve our profession and make this department better.
Mm-hmm. Well, the CERT, the team came out to speak to this just equal justice last year, and people were really struck by their knowledge of resources, the referrals that they talked about making, and yeah, some of what they shared, their perceptions of the impact on the department. So I wanted to ask you why you decided that it was something we needed to implement and the difference that it's made.
Well, there have been a lot of incidents in our country, in this country, regarding law enforcement officers getting into deadly encounters with people that are unarmed or suffering through mental illness. And, you know, that has been a conversation on how we better equip and prepare our staff to deal with those issues. And it all came about just really something simple, just watching a television show on HBO one day called Ernie and Joe Crisis Cops. And it was a documentary series about these two officers in San Antonio, Texas, that are their mental health team down there, or part of their mental health team. And their agency is huge. And they have, I think they have 24 hours officers doing this mental health team. But I watched this docuseries and I'm thinking to myself, why don't we do something like that here? Right. I mean, and do it better. And so they just had two officers that were highly trained in dealing with folks suffering through mental illness. And then they had relationships with the mental health providers in their community to deal with those issues. So I just happened to be having a conversation with the sheriff at one time about it at coffee. We had both watched that. We're like, why don't we start thinking about something like that here? But let's add the component of a mental health professional with that team. Bring that person in. So there's not the referrals. We have that person there. We have access to those records. We have access to get that person. We know what drugs or medications they're supposed to be on, or what they're not taking, what their recent treatment's like, or if they've never had treatment. All of these things are really good background information to have when you're dealing with somebody in crisis. And then especially if you're trying to get them treatment and then get them, you know, check up on them down the road. So unfortunately, the sheriff's office could never commit and they never got involved, but I wasn't going to wait for them. And so we started ourselves. And we were able to get a contract with HHSA and get a mental health clinician assigned to our team. I was able to put two officers in there using some grant funding that we had through housing to deal with, you know, getting folks that are on the street into some sort of housing. And it wasn't really where I thought the team would go, but the folks that we put in there, Devin Kettle, and Teddy Snyder originally, and then Joanna Bland now, they took this program from what my brainchild was and what I had talked to them about and turned it into something far better than what I had dreamed. And so they're going, you know, into the camps and actively trying to get folks into treatment, drug, alcohol, mental health treatment, and housing, transitional housing, and have done an incredible job doing that. And then also doing what I had originally envisioned, which was responding to these calls for service where there's crisis or they see somebody down as they're driving down the road that's maybe in crisis, speaking to themselves or walking in traffic or all of those things. And then dealing with those issues at the time, and then also having the ability to go back and follow up with folks and make sure that they're still staying on treatment. Just one example. We had a gal that called us multiple times a day, 911, because she thought, you know, there were bugs crawling on her walls. She thought people were listening into her telephone. She had microphones and all of these things going on. And the CERT team was able to help get her into treatment. She had several dogs. And the whole issue is she couldn't leave because she had these dogs. She didn't trust anybody because she was off of her medications. And so they established this rapport with this gal. They were able to get Haven Humane to take her dogs for 30 days so she could go into residential treatment at no cost to her, and then get her into treatment. And then we don't hear from her anymore. She doesn't call 911 anymore. She's out. She's better. She's doing everything she can. She got her dogs back. And so that's the kind of thing that they can do that that our police officers don't have the ability to do. They just, you know, they just can't. And so they've taken that program to new heights. And now we've doubled it. We have four officers. So we have 6 day a week coverage. I'm still waiting for that second clinician from public health, but I keep being told it's coming. So that team will have another clinician at some point. But yeah, it's been a cool, very cool program and something I'm very, very proud of that we were able to get that going. Mm. But it's all about, you know, getting the right people in the position. We could have, if we put the wrong staff in that position that didn't have that, that weren't ready to take on that challenge and really grow that program, it may not have been as successful, but that's about having a good team in place and selecting the right people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you mentioned them being able to do things your officers don't have time. And what I remember, not only, all officers have a tremendous amount of mandated training, right? But they have additional training and they can go back and check on people. Is that correct? Yeah. Multiple times.
Yeah. The CERT team has expansive training. They get training that only mental health professionals get. And then, as I said, they have a mental health professional with them. They get advanced training in crisis negotiations. It used to be called hostage negotiations years ago, but it's crisis now because these folks don't always have a hostage. They're just in crisis and they're suffering. And so having them train in those to be able to sit and negotiate with somebody and be able to have the time and discipline to talk to these folks and get them to surrender when they're a danger to themselves or others, so we don't end up in a violent encounter or a deadly encounter. I mean, that's huge for us. That's huge for any law enforcement agency. And And obviously that's the way we want those encounters to end. So having them, having those skill set is very valuable to our community.
Mm-hmm. And how has having them there and the observations that they bring to the department, how has that affected culture or officer awareness of?
Yeah. I mean, so that it started slow, but as they became better trained and the other officers saw what kind of work they were doing and the effect that they could have, it's, I mean, when we tested for the cert position, when we added two positions, I had multiple officers wanting to do that role. It wasn't one of those things where I had to force somebody into it. Lots of people wanted to do it. Surprisingly enough, people I never thought would want to, that did. And so they've seen what kind of work they can do and what kind of difference they can make in the community. It's fun to watch them. You know, I've watched, and I think Devin Kettle was probably one of them that was that year. And Devin, I've watched him work, and Joanna, and, you know, just doing something as simple as handing somebody a hamburger or a Gatorade, which they carry in the back of their cars. They make a huge difference building that rapport with people. And then getting them to do, you know, get in their car with them and go somewhere and get treatment or go into housing. And sometimes it takes days or weeks or whatever to build that relationship. But then they finally get there and then they can get that person. And then now that person's back to being a productive member of society and not, you know, living on the street somewhere and struggling with addiction. So that it's a really cool program. And we could have four cert teams easily. And have 24-hour or 20-hour-a-day coverage. We could easily do that in this community if we had the resources to do that.
What do you anticipate being the future of CERT, and what would it require to make that happen?
Well, my hope is we don't need CERT in 2 years, right? Mm. Or at least in the same thing. I would hope that we get to a better place in our community or every community where we have less folks that are suffering through homelessness and addiction. And we don't need them to be doing that role. And, but I don't know, maybe that's a pie in the sky, you know, thought process, but I don't think we will expand the program yet. We might expand the program out into the county, maybe more if the sheriff can get to the point where he can do that. Or the city of Anderson wants to join, or the city of Shasta Lake, and we want to try and add some more resources that way. Ideally, I would love to see some more transitional housing show up in this community, that we were able to get more people into treatment so that we always have a bed for somebody, whether that's more pallet shelter type communities, whether that is more hotel rooms, whatever that looks like that we have to do. We could talk about the county and the COC and getting those things done. But I mean, my hope, as I said, is we don't need a CERT. I think we always will, but I don't, I'm hopeful that their role kind of is not so much having to deal with that, because we've figured out a way to fix homelessness.
Yeah. Well, agreed on the transitional housing and housing in general. You know, another huge effort was the whole body cam.
Yeah.
Project. And I know that's something that Shasta Equal Justice Coalition was really interested in. I was hoping you could talk to us about what was required in the process of thinking about that, vetting it, and what brought you to that decision that this is important.
Well, two things. You know, in my early days when body cameras first came out, I wasn't a large supporter of them. I felt that they were put out to be this panacea that they really weren't going to be. And then the legal side of it was crazy. There wasn't really any guidelines for when things can be released, when they can't, what's a public record, what's not, how do you deal with privacy, all of these things. So I'm glad we waited. I don't think we need to wait this long, but I'm glad we were able to wait and let a lot of these other bugs get worked out over time, and then get to the point where we could do it. Then in the end, when we were ready to do it and we saw that, you know, this was going to be a good thing for us, then it just came down to money and personnel. And so I knew from talking to other agencies that had cameras, you know, they start off with these cameras, they get them for free or nothing. And then a year later, they're out of contract, or 2 years, and they're full of, their storage is so expensive on the renewal. And they're stuck between a rock and a hard place because they have to continue to pay for all of this evidentiary storage, this digital evidence, but the cost is tripled or quadrupled. And so now the way contracts work, I think we're in a better place, but we had to evaluate these vendors and how they do evidence. A lot of them in the old days, it was, you had to have a server on your local network here at your department and you stored everything there. Now everything is cloud-based evidentiary storage. So there's several different providers that do that, that meet the requirements of CJIS and Department of Justice, and can do evidentiary storage, and that's what we ended up doing. The other issue is you have to have staff to manage a program. For us right now, we start off with a lieutenant who has other responsibilities, but he's the overall project manager. And then we have two community service officers that are doing all the day-to-day work. That's every day looking at the videos that have come in and making sure that the videos that are assigned to cases that, you know, where an officer makes an arrest, or they investigate, let's say, a domestic violence case and there's a suspect, they're making sure that those videos are all cataloged together and pushed with the case over to the district attorney's office, so they're available for the courts, for the district attorney and defense counsel in discovery. And that's a lot of work. And then we also have public records requests that come in and will come in. They haven't really started much yet because we just started the program, but they are starting to trickle in. And so they have to go through and fulfill those requests. And the video on those requests is not raw. It has to be redacted. And so we have to, by law, redact witnesses' faces. We have to redact addresses. We have to redact the inside of homes of victims. Victims have to be redacted. So there's all of these things that we have to do. And frankly, the software to do that has gotten much better over time. You now have some AI that's in there now that helps us do that. And we can do that with less staff than we would have needed, say, 2 years ago to do a body camera project. But so for us, this project is, you know, two personnel, full-time personnel, and then a lieutenant to manage it that does other things as well. And he's here in my office. His office is right next to mine. And then, of course, it's the storage, the cameras. We're in excess of, for our 5-year project, we're about $300,000 a year for the cameras and storage. And then we're, another couple hundred thousand in staff costs and then answer. So we're really $500,000 a year. And the only reason we could afford to do that is because the city got money from COVID. We got ARPA money, and that ARPA money, we had that sitting there. We had to make a decision what to do with it. And the city manager and I discussed it back, well, it was a little over a year ago, and said, hey, let's make the council make this decision. We have this money out there. We can stand up a body camera program if they want to give us this money. And so we took it to council and they agreed. And here we are today. It took a while because you have a competitive bidding process. You have to try out all the different systems, see what works. We did a almost 7-month trial of different cameras and ultimately ended up with Axon, which, they're the kind of premier vendor of body cameras. And so far we're week 4-ish? Yeah, week 4, and it's going well. And The officers actually really like them. So it's good.
Yeah, well, I was going to ask you about officers. What have been their reactions, observations, now that it's been implemented? What are they?
Yeah, you're always going to have some that have been around forever that, you know, don't think that they need them and wonder why we're doing that. But the vast majority of our staff now, especially on the patrol side, is brand new. And I've hired over 60 officers in 4 years. And so they either are brand new in this field and they wore cameras in the academy, so they don't know any different. Or you have lateral officers that we've hired from other agencies in the state, and they had cameras. And then so they were, I mean, I had some that were like, can I buy my own? I just want to have one. Obviously, a lot of legal considerations with that. So we that for the I have not had heard a single complaint since we implemented the cameras. The officers have seemed to, you know, they're going through growing pains and trying to get that muscle memory and remembering to push the button. And sometimes they forget for a second and then they'll turn them on. But for the most part, yeah, it's been great. And it's resolved. You know, we had it just yesterday, the day before, we had a complaint from someone who, you know, said that our officers were rude. And we watched the body camera video and they absolutely weren't. And then, so you call that person, you go, come on down, I'll show you the video. And then they withdraw their complaint. And so it's been, that alone has been beneficial because we're able to resolve a lot of those complaints of he said, she said. So
Those are big innovations are risky and they come with both challenges and resources that someone like you would leverage in making them happen. So I'm wondering about your experience in underlying challenges that you faced and what were some of those resources that you called on?
Well, like body cameras, for instance, you know, all of our officers are under a union association. And so the union had questions about body cameras and what is it going to look like? And are we going to be sitting there watching their video live streaming it, or are we going to be watching it every day? And of course we can't, we have 90,000 calls for service a year. It's just not going to happen. But so what that came down to is initially me and then my lieutenant who's managing the program, Jeff Schmidt, having him sit down with the union board and their representation, their attorneys, and going over policy and giving them input into the process. Like here's what we came up with. We searched agencies all over the state and looked for the best policies we could find and took the best parts that we thought out of it and then handed it to them and said, please read this, come up with ideas. Tell us if you think something's not right. What can we do to, you know, to ease your concerns in this program? And, you know, it took several months of discussions, but that openness and willing to change, you know, they came up with some really good ideas. They're like, yeah, that's a great idea. Let's make that change. The policy is I had really no pushback. They have a very pretty ironclad contract and could potentially have pushed back more if they wanted to, but they didn't because we involved them in the process early on and gave them a voice. And I'm always willing to change. Like if our current policy, we get 2 months down the road or a week down the road or whatever, and there's something in that policy that's not working, then we change it. It's that simple. And make those changes to make it work. So that's one of the big things. Leveraging for the other programs, the CERT was about partnerships. It was partnerships with our housing department downstairs, really getting our council into it. And the city council, they just loved the idea when we presented it to them. And so they were fully invested. And then so coming up with that, you know, the dollars for that, you know, our current budget cycle, we didn't have to drop any of our new positions, but we have 9 officers running on cash from ARPA money for the next 3 years. And so we could have used, the city could have made a decision, hey, let's use that cash elsewhere. The council could have, but they chose to keep these programs up and running because they know the value in them, and have worked hard to get us staffed into these programs. So we're trying to be innovative. And I think we've done that. Park Ranger program is a very good example of that. Our parks are, our public loves our parks and we want them to be safe. And we don't want the criminal element taking them over. And so having park rangers 6 days a week out in these parks, on the trails, on bicycles, now we're on a boat. We have a boat that we can use to go out there. And we had a lot of complaints from the fly fishermen and what was going on in the river and some of the camps and the littering just the environmental damage, and the boat has been helpful in keeping an eye on those issues, but also just being out there and available for water rescues. And then our bike team, that was another thing. We wanted to be able to it's that old school community and policing conversation where it's get people, put police officers out of their cars and into the community. And we're not really a walking town, but we can get around on bicycles pretty quickly, especially these electric hybrid bikes we have. And so having those officers be all on bikes, being downtown in our business districts, dealing with little issues that pop up, and just having that presence down there and getting to know the business owners in those, that's been a very valuable program as well. They're doing some great work, dealing with some of the drug dealers that are bringing drugs into our, especially into our homeless communities, and dealing with those things at the source. So it's been great having all of these new programs in place.
Use of force has been, a rallying point for many people to examine what's happening, how can we address that? So I'm wondering, what have you learned and over the years about strategies for reducing use of force and the effects of use of force for people in the community, for officers, and what approaches have you been part of implementing at RPD?
Yeah, there's two issues here. There's uses of force that are, that we all
fatal
see
encounters
on TV, like George Floyd, like that are unlawful and unnecessary and give every member of law enforcement lumped into the same pot there and made to look terrible. And then there's those uses of force that are necessary and lawful, but they don't always look good. And so for me, it's about two things. It's one, it's building a relationship or having a relationship with your community so they have trust. And so they, when they ask questions because they're concerned, they see something on TV or whatever that may be, or a social media video, or they know that, they'll get answers as best as we can provide them. And holding people accountable when they do something, that's, sometimes it's something that ends up in somebody not having their job anymore. So we just have to make sure we hire the best people, train them very well. And that's something that we've done. And we continue to look at on a daily basis, and make sure they have the best equipment to do their job. The training that we have given them on, from use of force, de-escalation, the tools that we have given them now, everything from tasers to body cameras to all of these things, to the type of just the gear they carry on their chest, all of these things are making them better equipped to handle these issues. And also just knowing that a lot of these situations are not urgent. They can take time, slow things down, bring in resources like CERT, whatever they need to do to address these situations. And I've seen it. I've seen the way we respond to calls different. I've seen the way we talk to people is different. Sometimes in this business, people get upset with us because we'll walk away from someone. Let's say someone's in their home and they're suicidal and they're armed. We're not going to enforce a violent encounter. We will try and talk to that person. But if they're unwilling to do that, we're going to walk away. And some people get really upset by that. But when it's all over and that person has had time to either sober up or, they finally come to the conclusion that they can get some help or whatever it is, and we didn't go in there and force a violent encounter, then they're thankful. So it's just a matter of training, equipping, and a mindset change on these encounters. Sometimes they end violently, and that's part of this business. But having that our community to have trust in us that we're going to do the right thing, and if we don't, we're going to tell you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And one of our members, and he's currently a co-chair, Eddie McAllister.
Yeah.
Everyone knows Eddie, right?
Yeah.
Hard to find someone who does not know him. Uh-huh. But he talks a lot about trust and building trust. What do you see is needed in order to build trust with those communities that have been or felt marginalized? What approaches have you taken and would you like to see strengthened in order to continue to build that reciprocal trust?
Yeah. Well, one of the things that we do is we're a part of as many organizations as we can in our communities. So we have officers. We've had a sergeant in SCAR for years. I'm on multiple boards with nonprofits in this community. My command staff is all expected to be on boards with multiple nonprofits in this community, because that as I said, it builds that trust. It gets the community to see us in a different light, and we see the community in a different light. Right now, we're seeing something outside of just police work, and that's a good thing. We're heavily involved in leadership reading. We're involved on the ground floor with kids in the schools through our SRO programs. We have the camps that we're involved in the summer. We have, you know, our officers involved in Camp Hope. We have our own Shasta Youth Leadership Camp that we are heavily involved with out of Shasta College. And so we're trying to have as much involvement in the community and with folks that may not have interactions with police department on a normal everyday basis, or they just see stuff on TV and, you know, they don't have the ability to meet with us. I'm always open for conversations with, you know, any member of our community about, you know, anything law enforcement related or anything at this point. And I've always been that way. And I've had those conversations. I think we need to continue that. Some of those hard conversations, we need to continue having involvement in other things not related to police work. I love the fact that I've hired several African-American police officers. You know, that's, we don't have a large African-American community here. And so it's hard to recruit folks of African-American, you know, descent in this community, but luckily I've been able to hire several, and they're doing great work. We have a large Hispanic population of officers that are working for us now. So the diversity in my department now is way different than it was 4 years ago. I think that's partly because we're recruiting nationally, although I'll tell you, it hasn't worked out so well for us on the national level, but on the state level, we're hiring from all over the state. And I think that's helping bring folks up here that wouldn't normally have come up here and are now working for us. So yeah, I'm really happy with the way the department is shaping up.
What do you think are going to be some of the greatest challenges that, and who's going to be chief of police next, will face?
Well, there's a couple of things. Our budget, as I mentioned, we have, we're in a 2-year budget cycle just started. We have 9 officers. So that we added 9 or lots of new programs. Our park rangers, those 4 positions, and a new Beat 8, which is 5 officers. They're being funded by cash through ARPA for the next 3 years. And if the city does not start seeing our revenue growing back to what it was, we are at risk of losing those positions. And so that's going to be the big challenge. If we do start to see a decline in revenue and we have to adjust our budgets, what are we going to do? We're going to start freezing positions. What programs are we going to eliminate? Which ones are we going to keep? That's going to be a big challenge. The other thing is, you know, there's just Sacramento comes up with some crazy legislation. And I was actually waiting to see what happened today, but there's legislation right now that's still potentially going to get passed today, SB 50, which would ban law enforcement officers from making traffic stops related to mechanical violations, registration violations, lighting violations. And, you know, if you look at the reasoning that they're putting out there for this legislation, indicating that those things are used for pretext stops on folks and they affect marginalized communities more than others, that may be true, but you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. And really, that pretext stops are a valuable tool in solving crime, resolving crime in our communities. You think about it, one of the bans on this is bicycle violations. So if someone's riding a bicycle at night without a light, We encounter those folks a lot, but they also have a lot of times in the middle of the night, the only person out there in the middle of the night, 3 a.m. riding a bicycle around is a burglar. And them not having that light on their bike is a reason for us to stop that person and then ultimately find out if they are a burglar. They often have backpacks and they are full of stolen property or burglary tools. And we use those all the time, and that tool is going to go away from us. I'm assuming it's going to pass unless the governor vetoes it. And so now you've lost your opportunity to have a legitimate vehicle code violation to find out if somebody's committing wrongdoing. Is that abused? I'm sure it is in some areas of the country or some areas of California, but that doesn't mean that you take that away from everyone. And that's one of the things I get frustrated with, is everyone getting lumped in together, not having some local control. City of Los Angeles made a decision to not do pretextual stops. That was they decided to do that. That's up to them. Let that community make that decision. I guarantee you the residents of Shasta County or resident of Redding do not want us not doing that. And I'm going to feel really terrible if we start having, are not able to use that tool to, stop crime, especially late at night in the middle of the night.
Do you see like a local middle ground for something like that? Like,
I think you leave it as it is right now. So other cities can make decisions to do it differently. The city of Berkeley is doing it differently. The city of Los Angeles is doing it differently. Let them make those decisions and make decide that. If we wanted to do something that way, we could do the same thing here, through an ordinance or just through policy, right? And we could change on our own. But I don't think we need to. We're not randomly just stopping in every person for a taillight out. And sometimes those violations can be dangerous, especially riding a bicycle at night without lights on. You could be a victim. So. Mm-hmm. A car crash. So I just see a lot of that. That's one of the things I see happening, continue to happen, is legislation that could really change the way we do our jobs, make it more difficult. The other thing I'll say is, as I mentioned earlier, we've hired 60 police officers. And what we're seeing is, we have 122 officers now. We've basically, our entire patrol division is brand new. All our supervisors are brand new. And so we are, or most of them. And so we need to make sure that our officers continue to get trained, lots and lots of training. We need to keep the culture of what's great about Reading PD in place. We need to keep the culture of this community, ingrained in these officers. So that's going to be a big push for the next few years, is to take all these young new officers and make them what Reading PD is known for. Community policing and taking care of this community the best as we can.
And you're making me think, which we don't have time to get to today. I have two more questions for you, but just the role of data for you in reviewing, what actually is happening and some of the consequences and those conversations that happen with the community about basing it on actual data.
Yeah, actual data is really important. I mean, there is a program called RIPA that the state started several years ago, Racial Identity Profiling Act, that requires agencies. We just started about a year ago. It's been implemented in phases, but our officers, after every traffic stop or every consensual encounter or anytime they're out with somebody, they're required to enter information into this database about the reason for the stop, what was there a violation that they were cited for, arrested for, searched, and all of these things. That continues to grow. But if you look at that data alone, it does not, on a state basis, it does not support SB 50. You look at that data that's out there, and it doesn't show that certain communities are being having over enforcement over others. So I think that data is super important for us to look at and use and not make decisions based on what we're on emotions. And I'm a data guy. We've implemented a lot of technology into our department, and we've struggled with it in some cases and had to replace it. But the more data I can get out of that, our response times, we're struggling to get that from our last system. We implemented a new system a few months ago, and just be able to know, you know, where crime is occurring, how long it takes an officer to get there from one place to another, all of these things. That's all super important. Who are our habitual offenders, the ones we need to deal with, what areas are seeing more crime than others, and being able to actively deal with those in real time versus, you know, waiting for a monthly report. We had a crime map for a while. That crime map is getting revamped, and we'll have that back up, and then the community will be able to use it as well. But yeah, I am a little bit of a data nerd, and I like that data to help drive our decision making, and we're going to see it more.
Uh-huh. What accomplishments during your time as an officer or chief are you most proud of?
I think I'm most proud of the fact that we're fully staffed. We have some incredibly innovative, I think, programs for our community. I'm very proud of CERT, very proud of the Park Rangers, our bike team, our special investigations unit, our community work program officers, the work that they're doing. I'm proud of the leadership team that I have, that we have developed, not I, that we have some great command staff, folks in good positions, making good decisions and coming up with great ideas. And we're all on the same page, and that's hard, in, you know, to have that. So I feel like really good walking out the door. Like I'm ready to walk out the door, and I'm not worried about it. Very thankful for this community and my career here. And hasn't always been the easiest, but it's been a great place to work. This is a great city, and it seems to be going places. I hope that continues. And yeah, just looking forward to the future and getting in shape.
Yeah, well, I know some people that you can run and cycle with if you're interested.
I'm in.
Yep. Thank you, Chief Schuler, so much. And we wish you well. Thank you so much for sharing your reflections with us.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Signs and wonders for